Dr. Diane Dubinsky will now speak about her own perspective on our seventh principle.
Thanks and good morning. Let me just get my piece of paper organized here and my timer so I stay within bounds. So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Great to see everybody here. Right now, caterpillars are waking up. You might not be thinking about that, or you might not be feeling like spring yet, but as most of you are probably not thinking about caterpillars as well, but I am. So as an ecologist and a Unitarian Universalist, I want to tell you a few things about caterpillars, butterflies, biodiversity, and the seventh principle. So Unitarian Universalists affirm and promote seven principles which we hold as strong values and moral guides. The seventh principle is called respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. I should also tell you that the seventh principle was one that drew me to become a Unitarian Universalist, but it took a while. I first learned about Unitarian Universalists, ironically, in the context of interdependent webs of real spiders. I was an undergraduate working for an ecologist who studied spiders at the University of Maryland. When I started working for him, and I actually worked for him for about 4 years, I got to know his family, and sometime in the course of our conversations, he told me that he was a UU. I asked him about this unknown, unheard-of religion, and he sheepishly said something to the effect, "Well, they mostly play songs and they sing music." And so at some point during that course of 4 years, I was invited to a Unitarian service, and I did hear some pretty good music, but I didn't really learn anything about what Unitarian Universalists stood for until many years later. When I went away to graduate school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I lived in a co-op with 13 people, and I started to investigate different religions. I went to Buddhist temples, I went to Quaker meetings, a variety of places. And as I said, it took me a while, but when I first learned about the Unitarian principles, I knew that I had found a set of principles that resonated with my own perspectives. As an ecologist, I think about the seventh principle pretty much every day. I teach about climate change, I teach about conservation, I'm a field ecologist, I study butterflies, and during the summer you'll find me in a montane meadow or a grassland, usually with a big butterfly net in hand. So I think about that seventh principle, that interconnectedness. One of my favorite books is a book that is written by Luna Leopold. It's called Round River, and it's a compilation of the work that comes from the journals of her father, Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold was a wildlife biologist and conservationist who lived, who was active primarily in the 1930s and 1940s in the Midwest. And this book has become a classic reference for conservationists because it provides a well-articulated philosophical perspective to guide conservation actions. The philosophy is of taking a conservative approach to making decision-making in the face of uncertainty in order to protect species, ecosystems, and future options. Here's the quote from that book. "The outstanding scientific discovery of the 20th century is not television or radio, but rather the complexity of the land organism. Only those who know the most about it can appreciate how little we know about it. The last word in ignorance is the person who says of an animal or plant, what good is it? If the land mechanism as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. If the biota, in the course of eons, has built something that we like, but we do not understand, then who but a fool would discard the seemingly useless parts? To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." So that was Aldo Leopold. So what is a cog and who are the tinkerers? Well, in my mind, the cogs are the species. Each species plays a role in the environment. In ecology, we call that a niche. Sometimes we can define that niche with a high level of precision. For example, beavers are considered ecological engineers. Bees and butterflies are pollinators. But for many species, we may not entirely understand their role in the ecosystem. And we don't really know if that species disappeared, whether the loss of that thread of the interdependent web of life would cause harm, instability, collapse, or no change at all. When ecologists think about preserving that mosaic of diversity, we talk about the word biodiversity, and that is the diversity of species, habitats, genes, and even ecosystems. So who are the tinkerers? Well, that's us. We build things. Sometimes they fall down, like the roof of the gym. We reroute rivers, we pave over wetlands, we add dams, we till the land. Sometimes we restore grasslands or wetlands. So we are also ecological engineers, just like those beavers. We're big-time ecological engineers. So that means that we have a responsibility to be, what I'm going to say is, tinkerers that are also thinkers. So tinkerers that are thinkers. Got that? Okay. So here's a lesson from tinkering that I had back when I was 17 years old. So once, when I was a teenager, my friend and I decided that we were going to replace the water pump of our family car. The estimate for the repair was rather expensive, and my friend had a friend whose dad was a mechanic. So we figured we had some level of backup if things didn't go so well. My mom was probably a little bit more supportive of the idea than she should have been, said, okay, go ahead. So we started taking things apart. We popped the hood, started taking out the parts. We realized that the water pump was really under and behind a lot of other cogs and bolts and wheels. There were parts of the car all over the carport for a few days. We did call in our mechanical buddy for help. When we finally finished, we noticed that there were a few extra bolts and screws. Everything was back in its place, we thought. And yet, we had these three extra parts. It wasn't all that much compared to all the parts that we had taken out and put back. And yet, we wondered, would it make a difference? Would we be driving down the road one day and all of a sudden the car would just fly apart? In the end, the car did work and there were no big surprises, but it did make us wonder. And all this wondering is also relevant to those cogs that Leopold spoke of. So Leopold did not use the word conservative when he talked about tinkering, but I think that he had that perspective in mind. It would be a different meaning than the word that we would read in the newspapers on an average day now, or what a politician today would mean when they say conservative. In Leopold's mind, the intelligent tinkerer would take a careful, measured approach to decision making. The point is that humans are a part of this larger ecosystem. Today, that perspective might be called the precautionary principle, if you've heard of that. People have made many significant changes to the earth and even to this local landscape. If you drive around, you'll notice that, right? Or if you take a walk. However, it would be a smart strategy to take care of all of the cogs or the species within this ecosystem because we may not really know what all of them are doing. Even if they appear to be small and inconsequential, they may be playing an important role. And we may also want to think about taking a conservative approach to changing rivers, streams, mountains, valleys, etc., where those species live. So how does this relate to everyday life in Bozeman? People come to Bozeman for a variety of reasons. Overwhelmingly, however, they come here because of the natural world. They want to experience mountains, nature, skiing, or it may be fly fishing. People on vacation come here to see Yellowstone, wilderness, wildlife. And that links to our seventh principle. One of my missions as an ecologist is to get people to see not only what we call the charismatic megafauna, like bears, bison, and wolves, but also to slow down and notice the diversity of the amazing other organisms that are out there in this ecosystem. And not only to just see those organisms, but to value them and to think about how our decisions might affect them. One little cog that lives in this ecosystem comes out in late June and early July. It is a white butterfly that lives in alpine and montane regions called Parnassus clodius. The common name, which is not a lot easier, is Clodius parnassian. This butterfly is the color of snow. It has a fuzzy little body, dark black eyes, and if you will grant me some artistic license, I would tell you that it looks like a miniature polar bear with wings and antenna. But you have to look really close to see that. And here's the related butterfly I'll tell you about. So I usually speak with PowerPoint, so I'm doing my best to draw a picture with words. Sorry. So Parnassus eggs hatch into caterpillars when the snow melts. They spend all winter hibernating in the deep snow. Their bodies are pumped full of an antifreeze-like substance made of sugar that keeps them alive, but only to a certain temperature. They actually can freeze and die. And so the amount of snow each year, the timing of snowmelt, and the weather conditions that occur after snowmelt, like what we're looking at today, affect the survival of these eggs and caterpillars. You can think of that deep snow as a down blanket, covering them up and keeping them warm enough, just barely warm enough, not to freeze on a cold winter night. Right now, those eggs are hatching, caterpillars are waking up, and they're starting to move around, believe it or not. The caterpillar that I'm talking about is probably on the order of a millimeter or two long, at most. It's wandering around in the soil, looking for a particular plant. It's a very picky eater, and if you've read the children's book by the same title, it is also a very hungry caterpillar. These caterpillars are looking for a very small plant called steer's head. Has anybody seen that one? I've got some pictures over here on the table. I'll show you later on. That is the only thing that they will eat, that one plant. But this also means that they're very habitat specific. So only a montane meadow with steer's head will do. A meadow that has been plowed or turned into a lawn or modified in any way will probably not have steer's head. So after eating for a while, the caterpillars do what caterpillars do best. They form a chrysalis, they take a nap, and they transform into a butterfly. So when the arrowleaf balsam root with the big yellow flowers and the sulfur-colored buckwheat is in bloom, the Parnassus butterflies start to fly. In late June, it's almost like somebody flipped a big switch in the sky and the butterflies come out. The males come out first and they patrol the meadows looking for females. About 10 days later, the females emerge. They look very similar to the males. They're a little bit darker in terms of their body, and they're a little bit more secretive in their behavior. They are looking for places to lay their eggs next to that steer's head plant. The butterflies fly for about 3 weeks. They mate, they lay their eggs. The meadow becomes a flurry of white nymphs dancing around above yellow, red, and white flowers. The butterflies only fly when it's warm enough that you would be comfortable in a t-shirt. And it can't be too cloudy or too windy, so they're very picky about that. But it's because they're solar powered, actually. They only can warm up enough when the sun is warming up their muscles. They only fly between about 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. And as my major advisor, that Patty will remember, used to say, they quit at cocktail hour, which could be convenient. And then all of a sudden, in mid to late July, it's like somebody flipped the big switch again in the sky, and it's all over. They're gone. But are they really gone? No. The butterflies have died, but they left the eggs sitting there on the sagebrush or the small plants. They're only about a millimeter in diameter, but they have hard shells, these eggs do. They're attached tightly to a branch of a plant. They have to make it through the fall when the ungulates are browsing, through the winter when the snow flies, and then into the next spring when the snow melts to start that cycle again. Many people visiting Grand Teton National Park or Yellowstone who go on a hike in the high country might see a mid-sized white butterfly flying by with these gossamer wings. They might smile or point it out, or they might just walk by and not even notice it. Should they care? What is that butterfly doing out there? What are they doing in those meadows? Would we miss them if they were no longer there? Well, in Europe, the sister species of our Parnassus clodius is not doing so well. In places like Poland, Finland, Hungary, Parnassus apollo, the one on my t-shirt here, is listed on the red list, which is a list of effectively endangered species. Parnassus apollo has become an icon for PNNE National Park in Poland. I bet you've never heard of that one. But in PNNE National Park, they even have refrigerator magnets with Parnassus apollo, which is pretty cool in my house. If they have a refrigerator magnet, that's a big deal. Right, James? So when I visited PNNE National Park about 10 years ago, I was shocked to see how small that national park was. It's not like the ones around here. So the butterflies are doing okay right now because of captive rearing. But it's kind of a marginal case of hanging on. In Canada, near Banff National Park, there are also Parnassus species. In this case, the sister species is called Parnassus smithius. In those meadows, however, the meadows are shrinking because trees are moving up the mountains. In all of these places, the effects of climate change are probably impacting the populations. We've had a really good year for snow this winter. Those of you who like to ski notice that. But in the long-term trends, we know that snowpack is declining in the Rocky Mountains. So how does this all link back to the seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of life of which we are all a part? I would argue that it's not just important to be concerned about conserving the charismatic megafauna like the bears, the moose, and the bison. These enigmatic microfauna, or maybe charismatic microfauna, could also be critical. People like E.O. Wilson, a famous scientist who studies biodiversity, and ants in particular, would go so far as to say, it's the small things that run the world. And it may be that we can see changes in these smaller organisms much earlier than we will see them with respect to the bears and the bison. Butterflies have shorter generation times, so they respond more quickly to changes. And as such, we can call them our canary in the coal mine for climate change around here. So what can we do about all this? My opinion is that Margaret Mead was correct in saying, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has. I would agree. Our actions do matter. Climate change is a big problem. Some people would argue that we cannot make much of an impact as individuals, but I would disagree. Multiplicative effects of many small behaviors can have significant impacts. In fact, there are theories based upon this idea. And sometimes these multiplicative effects can push us over a threshold. As an example, take a look at how popular 16-year-old Greta Thunberg of Sweden has become recently. If you haven't seen her, you can Google Greta Thunberg of Sweden, who spoke at the last IPCC meeting about climate change to the world in Poland. So she's pretty amazing. She was 15 years old. Respect for the interdependent web of life means that we might opt to leave the natural world alone sometimes. We might also need to manipulate it, for example, if we want to restore a grassland or a wetland habitat that has been lost. But regardless, we take a conservative approach. We embrace a little humility in realizing that we may never be able to define all of the niches. We have to leave that for next generations. But meanwhile, we have been intelligent tinkerers and we have saved all of those little cogs. We have preserved the biodiversity and the ecosystems for future generations. And in my opinion, that is how we respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So thank you, and thanks to my family who helps me with this field work every summer.